board to reconvene, and we are on item 8C.
Yes.
Whiskey Mountain, Deer Mountain Lion Study. Who's the presenter? Matt?
Yes.
Well, you get it started.
Get it, yeah. Put your foot in the water.
Good morning, board. Board Supervisor Matt Parker, Natural Resources. Today we have a deer study presentation from California Fish and Wildlife Consultants, and we'll get the presenter lined up.
Good morning. Hello? Can you hear me? I feel like a little moody with the announcement on the telephone. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Are you there?
It takes a while to get the message there and back. Where did you come
from? Mr. Whitmer, are you there?
You need to press the button on the...
No, it's on. It's on.
Hey guys, can you actually hear me?
Hear me. Yes.
You can go ahead with your presentation when you're ready, and let me know when you'd like to switch slides. Mr. Whitmer, are you there?
Fiber optic cable, so yeah.
Mr. Whitmer, are you there?
Can you guys hear me now?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
String between cans.
It's a long. Yeah, pull the string tight.
So I just got an email. Responding to it, no, I'm not able to hear the room anymore. As soon as you guys unmute me, I can't hear anything anymore. Would it be possible to maybe allow me to share my screen with you?
I'm sorry, we're not authorized to do that. I'm not able to hear you.
Okay, I mean, I guess I can't hear you anymore, but I can possibly start with a condensed version of the presentation. I had prepared a little bit of a bigger presentation with some interesting maps and videos, but if it's not possible to share my screen with you, then I'll just go with the shorter one. So I'm just going to start talking until I hear otherwise from you. My name is Heike Whitmer. I'm a wildlife ecologist and professor at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. And I'm going to talk to you today about the Cistudio Mountain Lion Study. So you may be asking why someone who actually lives in New Zealand is doing a deer mountain lion study in Cistudio. Well, that's because I used to work at... We can hear you fine. Okay, good. I just continue talking. Well, that's because I used to work at UC Davis before I started working here in New Zealand. And at that time, I was involved or was the principal investigator on the Mendocino deer and lion study established relationships with CDFW, which then allowed me to do some follow-up studies with you guys. So the CISQDR mountain lion study was quite challenging for us to do. I'll please ask you to go to the next slide. All right, so it was quite challenging to do because it ended up ranging over a very, very large area. And of course, so all deer together ended up using areas of 2,500 square kilometers. And pumas ended up ranging over 6,000 square kilometers. So we had to do a lot of traveling in trucks to follow our study animals. We also had a lot of natural disasters being thrown at us. We had studies where trees in our summer camp at Truck Creek came down and destroyed our office tent. And of course, we all know about the fires and COVID, but very glad we were in the end able to finish fieldwork in July of 2020. And so what I want to do today is to quickly talk to you about some of the results addressing some of these objectives that we were supposed to address with this study. And the main objectives really were to determine population structure, including seasonal ranges of mule deer in our study area in CISQ, estimate age-specific vital rates, so that's survival and reproduction of deer, come up with an estimate of how is the deer population doing, is it growing, is it declining, and some sort of like density estimate, and also try and understand and tease apart the effects of food, weather, and predation on deer population dynamics. And we used a range of different methodologies to try and address these objectives. And one of the reasons of why I happily agreed to give this presentation today is because I do know, and I have heard about the CISQ Board of Supervisors actually being instrumental of getting the study of initially approved by CDFW, so thank you for that. Next slide, please. One of the reasons, of course, why I particularly liked to still have a study in California was because it allowed me for 2 months of the year to get away from winter in New Zealand and go right into summer in California. And I probably spent from 2015, 2016 onwards every year about 2 months in the field with all of my field assistants and postdocs, so that was always quite fun. And what this photo is supposed to show is just it shows a deer that was actually caught by Richard Callis, and it shows the main methodology that we used. We ended up, or CDFW ended up capturing deer. Those deer were fitted with GPS collars, adult deer that is, and we followed those deer to try and get survival estimates, but also find out what kills them. And my group, students, postdocs, and technicians, we were responsible for catching fawns. And so over the course of this study, we were able to catch and tag with VHF devices 145 fawns, which is a very nice sample size. And of course, CDFW captured 82 adult female deer for us, which also contributed to this study. Next slide, please. So one of the most interesting outcomes for me of this particular study was this incredibly complex migratory system of deer with multiple seasonal ranges. And that very first slide that I used to open up the presentation, it was actually a slide taken from a remote camera, and it showed six deer migrating between seasonal ranges. There were two females in the front, quite alert. There was a little fawn hiding behind, and then there was a yearling buck followed by two male females. And we ended up, in the beginning, CDFW caught deer on winter ranges, and then later we caught adult deer on summer ranges. And as a consequence of that, we ended up with a really interesting mix of different migration strategy. Namely, we had individuals that were migrant, but we also had a few resident deer that actually never migrated at all. Overall, migration distances were quite significant. The average across all individuals was 33 miles. So that's a pretty decent migration. What this slide shows you is it shows you a topo map. You can definitely see Mount Shasta there, and we are, of course, to the right, where the summer ranges are. And then what you can see is how there are these migration corridors that deer use to move to and from these seasonal ranges. And One reason of why I'm showing this slide as well is because several of our deer, of course, had to cross highways. On this map, you can see several of the migratory deer crossed Highway 97 at several locations. And we also had resident deer that were crossing Highway 89. And everyone who ever drives from McLeod out east knows there's a lot of deer around that highway, and I'll get back to this a little bit later because I do think it's probably an underappreciated problem for this particular population. And further analysis with respect to seasonal migrations are underway. We gave all of our data to CDFW, who's currently involved in a Western US-wide project where all migration corridors of deer populations are being mapped. And so the Siskiyou population and also my previous study, the Mendocino population, are now contributing to this analysis. But again, very, very interesting population structure with lots of different seasonal ranges and very interesting migratory patterns of deer. Next slide, please. Okay, so jumping right into these estimates of vital rate. So again, we collared fawns, put telemetry devices on them, and then we drove around in our trucks every evening and we're checking up on their status. So basically trying to find out if they were alive or dead. And we got really good data for about for 3 years, and for those 3 years we could calculate an overall average of the annual fawn survival rate. And the overall average was 0.316, which basically means that about 31 fawns of 100 fawns in the population will survive the first year of their life. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it is actually slightly higher than the overall average for mule and black-tailed deer calculated across all studies that have ever been conducted. There was variability among years, and that is being shown by a range in annual survival rates from 0.217 to about 0.461, and that is not unusual. Fawn survival usually is quite variable because they respond more to environmental conditions, but also sample sizes sometimes simply play a role. Most of the fawn mortality occurred over the first 6 months of their life, and again, that is quite common for fawns because that is simply when they're neonates, they're newly born, and they still need to figure out how things work. And because we were every day in our trucks monitoring the status of those fawns, we have a very good results when it comes to trying to determine causes of mortality. And so for 90 fawns, we were able to establish known causes of mortality. Next slide, please. What this slide shows you is showing you the number of mortalities according to individual categories. And you can see we differentiated between predation, and there were actually five categories for predation. There was coyote, black bear, mountain lion, bobcat, and unknown predators. So that unknown predator is essentially a mortality site that we investigated where we were pretty sure that it was killed by a predator. For example, there was blood on the ground, but there were just signs that made it almost impossible to determine which particular predator species it was. And predation made up for about 77% of the known causes of mortality of fawns. And again, that is not uncommon. Remember that in deer, of course, fawns are premature, and again, they still need to learn selective environment. We had a few road kills, three. We had a couple, very low number of natural mortality, only two. And we did have a few unknown mortalities as well, 16 overall of those 19. And those are simply sites where, despite our best efforts, we came in too late to go in and confidently determine the cause of mortality. Again, we used a range of methods to determine cause of mortality, and I would have had a couple of nice slides for that. So we would find those deer, we look at sign of predators, we do necropsies in the field, and that really helped us to understand what actually killed those fawns. Next slide, please. So I'm quite happy with the outcome of our study looking into survival of adult females. We did not collar bucks as part of this project, simply because from a population perspective in ungulates, the males really don't matter. They only need to get females pregnant, but what happens at the population level is solely determined by females, and that's why we only collar adult females. And we were able to get data for 5 complete years, and this is what this slide here shows. It shows you 4 study years starting in June onwards to May the following year. It shows the yearly survival rate, and you can see there is actually not that much variability. It's sort of like ranges from just slightly under 0.8, which means that 8 out of 10 deer would have survived a given year, but it goes as high to just slightly under 0.9, suggesting that 9 out of 10 deer would have survived. And what those bars show, they show you confidence intervals, and they completely overlap. So there's absolutely no significant difference in survival rates that we found across the different years. On average, female survival was 0.838, again, meaning that about 84 out of 100 adult female deer would survive a given year, and that actually is dead on the average reported across all deer studies for this species. So, yeah, not much going on. Quite interesting, stable, and sort of like average female survival. Next slide, please. And so here I've summarized the known causes of mortality for adult females. It's a little bit easier to determine the cause of mortality in a female simply because there's more to see on the ground. They take longer to be consumed by predators. However, in the first 2 years, that's when the study was still primarily led by CDFW, and so there wasn't any information of cause of mortality, and so it really only started trickling in when research took over field work. But we had 22 adult females with known causes of mortality, and again, predation is the primary cause of mortality. From this slide, you can see that mountain lions were responsible for 10 of the deer that died during our study. You can see that coyote actually killed 5 adult deer, and that was a bit of a surprise. In previous studies, I had not come across, that I was involved, I had not come across coyotes killing adult deer. Very little malnutrition happening, only 2 deer were in bad, really bad body condition, a few unknowns. Predation is the primary cause of mortality. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that the deer are nutritionally stressed, and that's why they're dying. And the results in terms of both survival and causes of mortality are actually really comparable to what we know from other deer studies. Next slide, please. We also, during capture, determined the number of females that were pregnant. The way you do this is you take a blood sample, and then you send the blood sample to a lab, and they look at progesterone levels and determine whether the deer was pregnant or not. And then, of course, only looks for deer that are caught in winter. From these analyses, we know that the pregnancy rates were very high in the population. They were 0.949, so basically 95 out of every 100 female deer that we would catch were pregnant. So quite high pregnancy rates, very little variability among deer as well. And then the number of fetuses, that was really quite cool, how CDFW jumped on board and helped us get some data on that. So basically, the way you do and find out how many fetuses, how many little baby deer females have in their uteri, is you use ultrasound, exactly the same way you do in humans. And these ultrasound then allow you to find how many fawns are there expected to be born. And again, that happened over several years and for 39 individuals. And what we found was that actually most of the females that were pregnant would have carried twins. So the average across these 39 individuals was 1.86, so almost 2 fawns per individuals. Those are quite high rates compared to other studies, high pregnancy rates and high number of twinning rates, indicating that it's probably it's a clue that nutrition is unlikely a limiting factor in the population. Next slide, please. So in this slide, it's a bit complex. What I was basically trying to do also, can have access to those slides, of course, and it's basically just a summary of those vital rates that I've just presented. So on the left of the table, you see the name of the vital rate. Parameter estimates are simply the estimates that I just presented to you, filled in with some further estimates that we could really determine from our own study animals. For example, we simply did not have a very large number of yearlings that we could follow, and we also really didn't have pregnancy information for yearlings, and so we sometimes use data from other studies to fill in those gaps in our own knowledge. But then we basically used a matrix model approach to try and estimate whether the population is increasing or declining. And based on our best estimates of vital rates in the population, the lambda, the population growth rate, is 1.027, indicating that the population is most likely growing at about 3% a year over the course of those 4 to 5 years that we actually study the population. So you can see from the values in brackets, basically a lambda that is larger than 1 indicates that a population is increasing, smaller than 1 does suggest that it is declining. And so there's quite a bit of uncertainty in those estimates, suggesting that, yeah, it could be declining. It could, however, also increase much more rapidly. But on average, our data suggests that the population is probably slightly increasing. On the very right of this table, called elasticity matrix element, now that is an analysis that allows you to determine how sensitive population growth is to individual vital rates. And what those values tell you, it tells you that the value for adult female survival of 0.57 is the highest compared to, for example, fawn survival or yearling survival or any of the reproductive parameters that we estimated. And what that really simply shows is that the population will respond strongest to any change in adult female survival. So if it were to decrease, the population would probably decline. If it were to increase, population would probably increase even faster. So that's basically what, what it shows us. We should really pay attention that adult female survival doesn't change dramatically. Next slide, please. So we also were asked to try and come up with a density estimate of deer across the study area, both on summer and winter ranges. And we were also tasked with coming up for an estimate in sex ratio of deer in the study population. And that was because a hypothesis had been proposed that a male, a buck only hunt had resulted in a biased sex ratio where the bucks in the system are just too few to get females pregnant. And so what we did to address those questions is we used pellet surveys and subsequent analysis of DNA and then marked recapture analysis to estimate densities for females, males, adult females, does, bucks, fawns, adults, and total densities for both summer and winter ranges. And that is a methodology that I had developed with Ben Sachs during the Mendocino study, and it's now used across the state, of course, to try and estimate deer densities. And there's two quite interesting results here that you can see. And so first of all, if you go to adults, and you look up, you can see that on summer ranges, we're just below 6 deer per square kilometer, and we're just below 6 square kilometer as well for deer on winter ranges. So that is comparable to other areas in the state, lower than some, higher than some. I would interpret those results actually as having room for increase. Because I just don't think that the population is food limited. There's quite a lot of forage that we could see every year on summer ranges, and you know, if we keep winter range habitat available, they also should maintain these sort of densities. And the second outcome And what was nice about this study too is that there's an asterisk for fawns, indicating that fawn densities were significantly different on winter ranges compared to summer ranges, and that really sort of like confirms our previous estimates of these survival rates for deer, showing that over those first 6 months when they're on summer ranges, most of those fawns, well, a lot of the fawns are actually dying. And it's just nice to have confirmation using an independent method to confirm that result. But the second really important result from this analysis was that we found a buck doe ratio of about 2.16 does for every buck. And as you could see from the pregnancy rates results, there really is no indication right now that there's simply not enough bucks in the system for does to become pregnant. So those were quite interesting results as well from the study area, and we're quite happy with them. Next slide, please. All right, I thought I'd show you a little bit as well about pumas or mountain lions in our study. So I've really, over the course of my career, realized the advantage of trying to study predators and prey simultaneously if you want to understand the impact of predators on prey. We've done this before in the Mendocino study area, and the outcome were quite interesting because in Mendocino what happened was that kill rates of pumas were quite high, and that was because we were among the first who could demonstrate that high kleptoparasitism, that's a term indicating when a predator species essentially steals the kill from another predator species. And high kleptoparasitism from bears in Mendocino was really driving high observed kill rates of mountain lions or pumas in that particular study area. And so I convinced CDFW to again fund a puma study in the area as well. And we, so not CDFW, the university folks were responsible for doing all puma captures. We caught four mountain lions, five females and nine males over the course of our study. And again, they ranged over a very large area, 6,000 square miles, which made monitoring them quite challenging. Eight of those 14 mountain lions died during the study area, so lots of turnover actually. Three of them were illegally killed, and three died due to interspecific aggressive behavior among males, so simply other males, for example, killing younger males, getting rid of competitors. And two died due to collisions, one collision with a car, and I still don't quite know how that happened. One actually died from a collision with a train. Interesting aspects of the puma population or the mountain lion population was that, again, they occurred at relatively low density, and due to their migratory behavior, where they essentially followed, or some of them followed the deer migrations, they used very, very large ranges. Next slide, please. So these mountain lions were fit with satellite-enabled GPS collars, and we could download location data every 3 days. We could then plot the location data onto maps, and whenever there was a cluster, sort of like indicating that a mountain lion stayed for several hours at the same location, we would, during intensive monitoring period, go out and try and investigate that cluster of location to try and find out if this was, say, a bedside where a mountain lion was simply sleeping, or whether it actually was a kill site. And when it was a kill site, we could determine the prey species, and we were able to confirm 486 prey species, and by far the majority of prey species of pumas or mountain lions in the study area were deer, 367. Particularly some of our males, interestingly, shifted their habitat use from more forested areas in winter into more open areas in summer, and a couple of them ended up hunting elk. So also we found 18 elk. We also found a pronghorn or I believe. So a few ungulates. In terms of biomass, definitely ungulates are the bulk of diet of mountain lions in our study area. But we did also found a few smaller prey items. Among others, they also killed actually quite a few coyotes. There's two graphs here. The one on the left shows you the kill rate in terms of ungulates per week for the four different seasons of the year, spring, summer, fall, and winter. And on average, mountain lions in the study area kill about one ungulate per week, except during summer. And there's two possible interpretations for this. From the cause of mortality data of fawns, you can see that mountain lions did catch fawns. And so kill rate per ungulates per week might simply indicate that during summer, mountain lions are also just very good at killing fawns. And then, of course, they just have to kill a few more of those. But the other explanation, of course, is just that during summer, bears are most active, and they might zoom in onto kills from mountain lions to try and take them over, displaced mountain lions, and as a consequence, maybe mountain lions have to kill more frequently. And that's why the the graph on the right is quite interesting, because that is a kill rate in kilograms per day. So basically, trying to understand sort of like the diet and foraging behavior of mountain lions with respect to how much meat do they actually consume. And you can see there's little variability between spring, fall, and winter, but again, it is slightly higher during summer. So what does that mean? It means they kill about one ungulate per week, which is usually what you expect. Many studies across the Western United States and Canada have indicated that's quite typical, but there is slightly higher kill rates during summer, both in terms of number of ungulates per week, but also in kilogram per day, give an indication that similar to what happened in Mendocino, there's probably a slight evidence of for bears taking over some of the kills, forcing pumas to kill more frequently during the summer months. Next slide, please. We also spent quite some effort in trying to understand puma densities and trying to understand relative abundance of all of the major carnivores in the system. And so puma densities were tried to convert to miles. Apologies, since I work in science, of course we do things mostly in square kilometers. But I mentioned this earlier, puma densities were actually quite low. There were really only about one puma every 100 square miles, 0.22 to 0.36 pumas per 38.6 square miles were the actual results. So relatively low puma densities across the study area makes sense. Large home ranges, they need to migrate, follow their ungulate prey. And also, I told you, we had quite a bit of mortality happen, including from poaching. So those values really are indicative of a moderately, likely moderately hunted puma population. The graph actually shows these relative abundances of the different predator species, black bears, bobcat, coyote, and puma. And what you can see is that definitely on summer ranges, we've got quite high densities of black bears, whereas all the other predator species really only occur at very low densities or low abundances, and that is further evidence for higher kill rates being due to probably black bears. Whereas on winter ranges, black bears, of course, are most of them are hibernating, and so we don't see a lot of bears. We saw a few more bobcats on winter ranges, very little puma or mountain lions on winter ranges as well, but on coyotes aggregated on these winter ranges, that also confirms some of the adult mortality that we saw from coyotes. All of those happened over winter on winter ranges. Overall, though, I would simply say this is actually quite a healthy predator-prey system with all the larger carnivores that California should have been present, and of course, except the wolves who currently, start to recolonize some of those areas. Next slide, please. So those were basically the results I wanted to show you. This is a very brief overview, of course, of what we did, but I tried to pick out the most interesting results. and would sort of like finish off with a quick summary. So when it comes to the deer population, the vital rates were either average or slightly above average. So adult survival females was dead on what's known for the species, and fawn survival was actually slightly above average for the species. The most likely outcome for the deer population is that they, when we studied them, were probably slightly increasing, maybe about 3% per year. In my indication, there really is no reason to believe that the population is or was over that time period food limited. We had high pregnancy rates, high number of twinning rates, indicating that females are in good body condition. When we, particular on the summer ranges, it's very productive habitat. I would sometimes describe it as there's almost a sea of forage. I was actually surprised not to see more deer in these areas. So in my or our opinion, there's room for further growth for the population from a nutrition perspective. We definitely did not find any evidence for a highly skewed sex ratio. So that should really not be a problem for the population. We did see that predation is the dominant cause of mortality, but didn't really believe that that is limiting the population. It seems to be increasing despite predation being the dominant cause of mortality. And I think it's basically just a fairly healthy predator-prey system that we have there, which is actually quite nice to see. There were two things that I wanted to bring up from a management perspective is, I really think we need to probably understand the potential effect of road mortality more and what that does to the deer population. As I said at the beginning, I think everyone who ever tried from McLeod, for example, east of Highway 89, sees a lot of deer around the highway and also high road mortalities. We lost three fawns to road mortality while they were monitored, but actually three of those fawns that grew up to be yearlings and adult then also died due to road mortality later in life, so we couldn't, we didn't count that towards our known causes of mortality because they weren't really monitored at that time because their collars had stopped working, but further indication that that road mortality probably has maybe a little bit of a bigger effect than we were able to demonstrate. And again, remember when I talked to you about how any change in adult survival is probably going to have a large impact on the deer population. So if we can reduce road mortality, even just a slight little bit, it's very likely that the population could respond to that and increase further. And then, of course, I had a beautiful photo of the effects of fires that we had raging in 2020. I don't need to tell you about this. You live with these forest fires now. It looks like year in, year out. The big fire actually was right when we ended our study and weren't really able to sort of like look into possible effects of deer from those fires. But that's definitely something that we need to keep an eye on. In general, of course, fires also lead to regeneration. In a few years following those fires, deer forage tends to go up again. But this is definitely something that I think folks should continue and have a little bit of a look at road mortality and effects of fires. So last slide, please. So this really the last slide, and I just wanted to thank everyone for giving us the opportunity to do this study. And in Region 1, Richard Callis and Karen Kobach were really instrumental of getting this off the ground. At the same time, both of those, of course, retired now. And a big thank you to Christine and Pete, who then took over and who were just absolutely wonderful to work with. And they played a big role of why I think this turned out to be a quite successful study. Headquarters, big thanks to Craig Stowers, also retired now, who actually was the person who got the contract through in the beginning at a time when it was quite difficult to get these studies approved. And then my friend David Cassidy, who's a big asset in CDF for CDFW to have and is really looking after deer for you in the state quite well. Everyone involved in captures, deer, again, adults we capture by CDFW, and then of course mountain lions we capture by the university folks, let's call them that way. And then all my postdocs, technicians, and volunteers that were involved. And in terms of funding, big thanks to CDFW and the big game grants. So essentially all the hunters of California who actually paid for this study. Thanks to the U.S. Forest Service who allowed us to stay on some of these campgrounds like Truck Creek Campground for sometimes 3 months of the year. And who also provided in-kind opportunities of using housing short-term, sometimes allowed us to rent them, so that was great. The California Deer Association for a little bit of funding as well, and of course also all the private landowners that allowed us as well access onto their lands whenever we had to recover collars of deer that had died. And finally, of course also the two universities that have been involved, the University of California, Santa Cruz, through which we ran the contract. My friend and buddy, Chris Wilmers, of course, is based in Santa Cruz, and then also my employer, Wellington, Victoria University of Wellington, who was able to allow me to go into the field. So I was hoping that we could have a bit of a question and answer period, but I'm not quite sure how this is going to work, given that whenever you give me the right to speak, it sounds like that I can't hear the boardroom. So either you can, if you have any questions, either you can maybe type them in and I can read them or send them to me by email, or if not, then thank you to you guys for giving me the opportunity to present the results, and I hope you enjoyed the presentation, and all the best.
Do we have a way to do that?
Yes. He'll type the questions if you have questions.
Okay. Questions of the board?
Thank you, Mr. Whitmer. This has been a 15-year project for Siskiyou County, which started off with the limiting factor of the population for deer in our region. In particular, I think you were in the X1 zone, or the east side of Siskiyou County, in the study. So, I'll wait to see if we're...
He can't hear you.
Something's wrong with our mic.
Weren't you going to type the question? Or?
Yeah, she's trying to get connected. It sounds like her microphone's not working.
Someone's going to get her.
Okay. So do you want to type yet, or do you tell me when?
Okay.
I don't think they can.
Matt, can you hear
her? Yeah, hold on. I'm trying to...
You have to type.
Yeah. I asked if he could hear us, and I haven't got a response from him.
Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes, now I can hear you.
Oh, good. Woo. Yay.
First presentation over again.
So, ready?
Okay.
Go.
If you have any question, then I'm happy to answer them.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Whitmer. This is Supervisor Kopsev. This has been a 15-year project for Siskiyou County to get to the results you showed today. Appreciate the great work you've done on it. The initial question that we posed was, what's the limiting factor? Excuse me, and how do we grow the population? What would be the management recommendations that you would provide to Cal Fish and Wildlife with regard to increasing these populations? The tag numbers in, I'll use X1, that eastern side that you did the study on, have decreased over the last 20 years. But yet I've heard nutrition, habitat, everything seems to be pretty normal, but how do we shift that balance to grow that population besides the roadkill effort? Because, you know, a long time ago, you know, roadkill was at a higher number than it is today because the populations were so much higher. But, so, you know, give us some input on the buck to doe ratio. Should that be more does to the buck in there, and how do you increase that if that's a factor? Or again, what management recommendations do you give to the department to try and begin to send the populations on an increase?
Yeah, that's of course, it is actually still unfortunately a more difficult question to answer than you probably would like it to be. So first of all, regarding the buck doe ratio, so that question I really feel like we've been able to address quite well. There were concerns that buck doe ratio is to the point where females just simply don't get pregnant anymore, and that is definitely not the case. So I don't really think that there is there's any reason to be concerned about the buck doe ratio in the study area right now. So I think we addressed that quite well. With respect to food limitation, I also really feel that we addressed the issue of food limitation on summer ranges very well. Deer are not homogeneously distributed across those summer ranges. They seem to be more aggregated on these whenever there is terrain in the landscape. So whenever there's a little old volcanic outcrop that's forested, that's usually where there's quite a few deer hanging out, and that's also where there's actually quite a bit of food. So at least when we started the population on summer ranges, there was really no indication that food was limiting at all. It is a migratory population. As such, the population is always going to be at risk during migration. And so, yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate your comment about road mortality at one point probably even be having been higher simply because there were more deer in the system. But I do believe that road mortality is probably something that, from a management perspective, can be addressed, and by increasing adult female survival would help grow the population possibly faster. And of course, to do that, I had recommended in some other presentation and meetings to basically get Caltrans on board and see what can be done with providing either a fencing solution or overpasses or underpasses. Similar to what I used to be involved in the Highway 89 project just outside of Truckee. And of course, over there, Caltrans really did install both fencing and underpasses under the highway, and that significantly reduced highway mortality as well. So definitely don't dismiss this. I think we shouldn't dismiss this. I think you know, we need to get or recommendation is to get Caltrans on board. And by the way, we gave Caltrans all the data as well. So they have the location data. And try work with them on finding locations that are guided by our migration telemetry data. So that first slide that shows these sort of yellow spider web kind of thing. So zoom in on those migration corridors and see if we can do something to reduce highway mortality. And then the only thing about food availability, we've definitely not been as good at addressing food availability on winter ranges. It's also a lot more variable than on summer ranges. For example, you could see on the migration map that a lot of the deer were migrating almost 50 miles to the east and in the south. And that is the Day's Bench area. That is incredible productive habitat over there, winter range over there. There's from from visits during winter in that area and summer. There's actually a large non-resident population there. So I don't really think that there's much that can be done about, or that needs to be done about food availability in that particular area. But we also, of course, had some of those winter ranges in the juniper or sage kind of areas that are lower quality food, and we had much lower deer densities on these particular ranges. And then finally, you guys, of course, know this as well, the deer do come down to lower elevations and they're trying to feed a little bit on those private properties as well, some alfalfa operations and things like that. And whether there's just a reduced availability of winter range now for the population, I unfortunately don't really think that we've been able to answer that question conclusively. But also just want to highlight that we are still working with the data. And for example, we're currently trying to do a survival analysis where we're looking at availability to winter range as a direct variable to try and understand differences in survival. So I think we've been able to give guidance to the department on most of those issues. The only one where I'm still not quite 100% sure is actually about sort of like the food availability and winter ranges. And I hope that answered your question.
It helps. I want to zero in just a little bit back on the buck to doe ratio. I get that it's good, but couldn't it be better? Aren't bucks better adapted to, versus two does on one buck per se, that aren't they able to take on many other does during that time of the year when they're rutting? Where I was headed with that was, if the doe population increased, would that not be a factor to increase deer population?
Well, that is really interesting. I don't think it actually would. What you're suggesting, I think that would definitely work in a food limited system, because then you're essentially reducing the number of bucks, but you're still getting everyone pregnant, the does would be pregnant, and would probably have less competition with males, for example, in the population. Particularly in summer ranges, that is definitely not the case, and the does are really good at going through lactation, but then catching up in body condition to be pregnant again in early winter again, that is a very interesting point. I think that might be something that could be done in a food limited system, but given the limited evidence we had, particularly in summer ranges, I don't really see much evidence for that.
Okay, and then lastly, and I'm sorry to take up your time, but so in that eastern zone, the tags issued by the department are now at 750-760 a year. They used to be 1,500 to 2,000. What management style gets that number back up to increase tag availability?
That is a really good question as well. My only question is it, what are we comparing it to, right? Like, we might be comparing these very high deer tag numbers that used to be in the past. Those might have actually been also a consequence of there still being higher pressure on the predator population in the past. I mean, remember, we used to have even when I was doing the Mendocino study, we still had a bear hunt, and that was closed down. In general, we just, predators are no longer managed. It's just a change in management style. And so I'm just wondering about whether some of those really high tag numbers in the past were maybe a little bit artificially inflated by the sort of like management that was implemented, and whether we just can't quite go back to those numbers given the modern and current management that is happening at this ecosystem scale, if you know what I mean. but that is a very interesting question. It is definitely lower. There is definitely reduced opportunities for hunters as a consequence. And maybe we need to think a little bit more about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, any more questions?
I might have one. Maybe I missed it in your presentation. Did you give a ratio of predation by sex? This is Supervisor Howard.
A predation by sex? Well, that's quite interesting. In the report, so no, I didn't show... oh, sorry. Did you mean predation by puma sex, or did you think were you thinking about whether male or female deer are getting killed?
Male or female deer. I'm just thinking that it's more likely to reduce the doe population through predation because the bucks are a little more elusive.
Yeah, quite interesting. So we do have a figure on this in the report, which I think I asked Christine if that had been made available, and she thinks she said yes. And so on page 42, figure 18, there is an indication there. And what we've done is we split up the number of deer killed by mountain lions by age category of deer, and then looked at the percentage that fell into this age category. And, you know, it's actually quite amazing about how symmetrics are indicating that they're probably having a quite similar impact on both male and female deer in terms of predation. I mean, you know, we had bucks that were as old as 14 years old that were killed by pumas. And of course, we also had two-year-old bucks that got killed by pumas. I'm thinking on my feet here because I wasn't quite expecting that question. But if you then take into account that the sex ratio in the population is actually, you know, over two does per buck, then actually the predation pressure on bucks is slightly higher than it is on does in that particular population. And again, that also doesn't actually surprise me. And a lot of studies show that because, yes, they are more elusive, but they also have, they're very single-minded during several times of the year. They need to get big and strong to compete. And then at one point, they seem to not be as good at avoiding predators as the females are. So yeah, actually, I think the impact of mountain lions was slightly higher on the male segment of the population than on the female segment of the population. That's what the data show.
Thank you. I don't think there's any further questions.
We have members of the County Fish and Game Commission that are in the audience. I don't know if they have anything, but we'd like to get that copy of that report. Do we have that, Matt?
I can get it.
Okay.
Sure. Good.
Yeah. Wait, you got one?
I just do. I have one question. The area studied, and thank you for all your hard work. We appreciate that. The area studied probably historically wasn't a large number of animals, even years and years ago. And I can see why the food source would be better there. There is more logging, there's more disturbance of the ground, which in turn, you know, gives more new sorrel and so on. So the animals do better when there's more food. To me, this is a small area. Siskiyou County is fairly large. I feel studies are great, but we do see the west side of I-5 not doing well because the buck doe numbers aren't good there. Just some thoughts that I feel that the area studied could have been broader maybe and given us a better picture. We have a east herd from Medicine Lake east that migrates over into those valleys that historically were large numbers. Some of the ones that migrate from the Medicine Lake Highlands probably northwest were high numbers of deer. The area studied historically wasn't high numbers. And that's just kind of the point I'm making. And, you know, we're trying to get a big picture of deer numbers. and how to improve those animals and the numbers of them. So anyways, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Can I get your name for the record?
Steve? No, thank you. That was actually a really interesting comment. And just very briefly, so I couldn't agree with you more. At the beginning of the study, we were actually looking at trying to set up a second major study site west of Highway 5 and of Interstate 5. And that was kind of like abandoned because it, initially there were a few does captured out there with helicopters as well. But unfortunately, mortalities were too high capturing those does, and that was partly because that is such a challenging country, as you guys know much better than I do, to actually work in. So yeah, I do agree with you. It was a challenging study for us because 2,500 square miles of area used by deer resulted in, three permanent trucks that we put about 600,000 miles on, plus two or three additional trucks that we used during summer months when we were capturing fawns. And so that is a lot of effort, but you're right. What we did is only representative now for the east side of I-5, particularly for deer that have summer ranges sort of like in the on the east side of kind of like Mount Shasta going into that whole volcanic area there. So yeah, that is correct. You guys are responsible for a much larger area than that, and all we could do is provide fairly detailed information for one of those areas. And then your second comment was also, of course, really good. And all of us, are still very bad at understanding long-term fluctuations of deer in the landscape. I mean, you go back to Aldo Leopold in the 1930s and 40s, and deer were incredibly abundant. And then at one point, they go through these long-term fluctuations, and we really just don't yet understand them. And they happen all across the Western United States. They happen all the way up in Wyoming and in in Washington State. And we really don't know much about that. And again, what you said is really valuable. We're thinking still maybe a little bit too short term, and this study again, it's a 5-year snapshot that gives, in my opinion, very valuable information, but at the same time, we still don't really have a very, very good handle about what sort of like really influences these long term, decade long fluctuations that we see in deer anyhow. And you mentioned one of them, which is, yeah, there was logging, and after an area has been logged, it can actually for some time become quite productive deer habitat before it becomes less productive again, of course. So yeah, really appreciate those comments, and you're right. Our study could really just provide a little bit of a snapshot for the particular area of where we studied those deer.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that.
All right, thank you, and this really isn't a question, it's a statement. I'd really like some pressure put on Caltrans on Highway 3 in the D6 zone, because the mortality rate on Highway 3 is quite disgusting, and I have not seen one finger lifted to do anything by Caltrans to abate that in over 24 years. The only thing it has increased is the number of fatalities because of the number of commuters now that live in Scott Valley going back and forth across the hill. And it's disgusting, the carnage on that highway.
I just got a survey for Caltrans that just hammered them on that communication that.
I can't
so
even
so get I them. Would do the same. So you know, yeah. We
have I can't even pressure. I can't even get them to mow the ditch, which would help so you could at least see the deer. They won't even do that. Anyhow, that's my pet peeve for the day. Maybe I'll think some more and come up with another one. So I think we're probably going to go to lunch and go into closed at this time. It's one of the things I could get through, but they're all, everybody puts 10 minutes on the agenda, but
which you guys are.
I can't talk. Mr. Whitmire, can we release him somehow? I don't know if he hears me.
Yes, we can.
Okay. All right. With that, then, we're going to move to close.